Coming up next, another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237.
Welcome to another edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, president of Local 237 Teamsters. With us, we have a very special guest all the way from Chicago. His name is John W. Rogers, Jr. He is the chairman and co-CEO and chief investment officer of Ariel Investments. John Rogers also founded Ariel in 1983 to focus on undervalued small and medium-sized companies. John's passion for investing started when he was 12 years old, when his father bought him stocks instead of toys for every birthday and Christmas. His interest grew while majoring in economics at Princeton University. He was also the captain of the varsity team there where he played basketball. John, welcome to Reaching Out.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. And you have a long history in finance and also civic duties. So you had what many considered to be a pioneering parents, how your upbringing influenced you and how you grew up. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I was very, very fortunate. My mom was the first African-American woman to graduate from the University of Chicago Law School, and she graduated in 1946. And while she was there, she met my father, who was returning from World War II, where he had been an original Tuskegee Airman. And so they met in law school and got married, and they both were pioneers in their own way. They had very successful careers, both in politics as well as in business. So I was just extremely fortunate. Also, my mom's grandfather, J.B. Stratford, owned the Tulsa, lived in Tulsa and owned the Stratford Hotel that was destroyed during the famous Tulsa race riots about 100 years ago. So we sort of have a family of entrepreneurs and people who've been leaders in their community from one generation to another.
I'm sitting here, and you mentioned the Stratfords. My wife's uncle is a Stratford, and he lives in Maryland.
Oh.
And they have a long history. She's showing me their family tree. Somewhere down the line, I think you may be related.
I wonder.
The story sounds familiar. I mean, I've heard the story before. Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Yeah, the story sounds familiar. We got to talk further about that after.
Okay.
Okay, so for those of us, and look, you had a great upbringing economically, educationally. And for those who are on the other side of the tracks, you also play basketball, a pretty good basketball player because you played Division I at Princeton. Yep. Tell us about your experience playing basketball along with your academics.
Well, it was tough. It was really tough because, you know, school was hard. Princeton's, you know, not an easy place. And I was playing for a Hall of Fame basketball coach, Pete Carrill, and he was a legend. And I was borderline where I was going to make the team as a sophomore, because back then freshmen couldn't play varsity. And I barely made the team. And after I made the team, he basically said, you know, we're not sure how much longer we can keep you here, because you basically have no idea what you're doing. You know, you play hard, but no one's really taught you before the things you need to do. So it was extremely demanding trying to play for this brilliant coach when I had not been steeped in the appropriate background to be able to be a major college player. So practice was hard every single day. It was a challenge every day to keep up with the other players and intellectually understand the game the way that Coach Carrill wanted us to. But playing for someone that smart, someone who's truly a genius and a legend, it had an enormous impact on my life to see excellence up close and personal, and to see someone who could teach so well. You know, he taught me the importance of teamwork. He taught me the importance of valuing every possession, making sure you execute it perfectly every single time. And then finally, the other magical thing about playing at Princeton at the time, we had a lot of great players that were there at the time who ultimately did interesting things in their lives. Probably the most interesting was that Craig Robinson, who stayed with me on his recruiting visit to Princeton. When I was a senior captain, he was a freshman on the team. His sister came to visit him, and who ended up being Michelle Obama. And who could have dreamed that when Craig came to Princeton, that one day his sister would be the First Lady of the United States? And it had an enormous impact on my life.
And Craig is now the in charge of player development for the New York Knicks, and he went on to coach at Oregon.
Yeah, he coached at Oregon State after Brown, and you're right, he is the head of player development for the Knicks. As you know, recently Steve Mills, who also played at Princeton with us, was let go of his responsibilities as the president of the Knicks. But it's kind of a fun thing because, you know, Dave Blatt is also there working with the Knicks. So I have three of my teammates have been engaged in the Knicks. And so the Knicks are my favorite team.
And is this Dave Blatt that used to coach Cleveland?
Yes.
Okay.
So I used to try to – that was one reason my basketball career was tough. I was trying to guard Steve Mills and Dave Blatt every day in practice. And they both went on to play professionally afterwards. And they were tough to guard.
Now, let me ask you this question, because you did mention that the coach said to you and your sophomore year, I don't know how long he could keep you. Did you stick on the team?
I did. It was interesting, I think there was probably 11 of us who started out as freshmen. Four of us made the varsity. I ended up being the only one from my class that made it all through all 4 years, and I got to be captain. And I think he saw something in me in my work habits. And I was a good defender, but the thing that frustrated him basically when he said I didn't know what I was doing was because I didn't have a lot of vision. I was not a great passer, and the Princeton offense is based on vision and passing.
Right.
So that was the challenge that I had trying to learn to play under that system.
Yeah, I remember one year I saw them in the NCAA tournament, and they were surprising me with their ball movement. And that ball moved faster than the defensive hands and legs could catch up, and they actually end up upsetting a team.
Exactly. They beat UCLA in the tournament a while back, and
that was the game.
Yeah.
Yes. So, what made you decide to start your own business at the age of 24?
There's a couple things that were going on at the time. I had an investment strategy and philosophy that I believed in that I thought was pretty creative and original, focusing on smaller companies that were undervalued with sort of a Warren Buffett approach to investing. So I think when you're an entrepreneur, you want to make sure you have a new product or an idea that distinguishes you. The other thing was we were the first African-American-owned money management firm to start in the country's history. There had just never been a black money manager or a black mutual fund company. And I thought, being from Chicago, I was so inspired by George Johnson's leadership with Afrosheen and Ultrasheen, and of course, John Johnson, who had founded Ebony and Jet.
Were they related?
They were not related. But they were these two giant pioneers who had started their businesses at a young age, very involved in the community, making a real difference for all of us. And so when I saw what they were able to do as entrepreneurs in their respective fields, I said, I'd love to do that. And I had this passion for the stock market. As you mentioned, that my dad had gotten me involved in early on, and that gave me the confidence to start at age 24.
Wow. I mean, that's an American story. Business environments like you for your black business, when you founded Ariel Investments, how is it more than three decades later?
It continues to be a real challenge. So, we're 37 years old, and if I would have told you that we would have the performance that we've had outstanding performance over the entire 37-year period. We're number one in our category since March of 2009 in the market lows. I thought if you really performed well and did this job well, you would be getting lots and lots of new clients, and we'd be growing quite rapidly. It continues to be a real challenge. And when you look at so many of our peers have come and gone over these 35 years, because it's really hard to build a sustainable business in money management as an African American. The biggest firms like BlackRock have $7 trillion under management. We have roughly $13 billion. It sounds like a lot, but we're a rounding error to the big firms like Fidelity and Vanguard. So you're up there competing against these big guys. It's really tough. And then secondly, people, with the unconscious bias, implicit bias that's still in our society, some people don't think that black people are qualified to manage their money. Actually, John Johnson told me that when I was starting the business. He said, I'm not sure this is going to work because I'm not sure that white America is really to trust their money with black folks. And 37 years later, it continues to be an enormous, challenging environment for us as African-American entrepreneurs. in money management and mutual funds.
Now, this is Black History Month, so it's really appropriate that you're here with us and we're here talking about the idea 37 years later, you are still put in the category of can you manage money?
Yes. It is interesting. Melody Hobson, my co-CEO, sometimes we joke. We said that these anchor institutions in our community will use Black folks for certain things. And these are important businesses, but they're not the most profitable businesses. They will often use Black caterers. They'll often use Black construction firms. You know, the major museums in Chicago, the major hospitals, the major universities. But when it comes to financial services and professional services, often they come to the conclusion that's for the smart white guys. You know, and so Melody and I joke that if we went into catering, we'd probably have 90% market share of the museums and universities in Chicago. On the opposite extreme right now, we basically have zero market share. DePaul, Loyola, Roosevelt, Columbia, IIT, our biggest universities, our biggest museums, the Field Museum and Science Interest Museum, the Planetarium, the Aquarium, they refuse to work with Black money managers. They have hundreds of white firms they work with, but they basically said, you know, we're just really not interested. And it's so heartbreaking. Now, there's some breakthroughs, like the University of Chicago now works with 90 professional services firms, 15 money managers for the endowment. So I keep telling them, if the University of Chicago can do it and be successful, why can't the rest of the anchor institutions in our cities like Chicago and New York do that? It's the same here in New York, Columbia, Cornell, NYU, all the museums from the MoMA to the Met to the Whitney. They hire hundreds of firms, but they're almost exclusively all white, with very few exceptions.
You're listening to Reaching Out. This is Gregory Floyd, President, Local 237 Teamsters. With us is a very special guest, John Rogers, Chairman and CEO of Ariel Investments. He's also the Chief Investment Officer. So if we just happen to have a CEO or some board members from some endowments and some companies, and they are interested in contacting you because they want to know more about your business that you've been involved in for 37 years and managing and investing money, how would they do that?
We still have the old-fashioned phone. So if they call us at 312-726-0140, there's someone there 7 days a week answering the phone. And we work with individual investors as well as institutions. So people that have kids can invest in their 529 program with us in Illinois. We have mutual funds available for individual investors as well as managing institutional portfolios.
Now, Ariel is spelled A-R-I-E-L. Ariel Investments. Once again, that's A-R-I-E-L. Now, how did you come up with the name Ariel?
It's a favorite name of mine. I like the way it sounded. And it's kind of a silly story, but when I heard it first on a television show, there was a character on the show, and I thought, wow, this is a kind of interesting name. And so I said, if I have a daughter, I'm going to name my daughter Ariel. But what happened was the company started in 1983, and my daughter wasn't born until 1990. So the company's Ariel, and my daughter's Victoria.
Oh, okay. Now, Ariel is also the character in The Little Mermaid, right?
Yes. Yes. But we were way before the movie came out.
So, what is managing money in an environment like this? I mean, it's been an economic boom. Yeah. Tell us about your experience in this era.
Well, I mentioned briefly earlier, it's been a very, very good period for us. And I often, when I get to see President Obama from time to time, I remind him that a lot of folks, because when he came in as the first Black president, they were afraid of the markets. A lot of people got conservative and took their money out of the market. We doubled down and bought more of our favorite stocks when the market was imploding in March of 2009. And that's why we've had such a terrific run since then. So we've had terrific performance, as I mentioned, number one in our category since the market bottomed in 2009. And we've stayed very fully invested. We've been finding lots of good companies to invest in. And the momentum has just continued to build and to build. And the bottom line, though, too, is we should always say we are long-term investors. So we try to think in 20-year horizons, you know, not short-term.
Very good. Now, managing money for almost four decades, You're ranked among the world's 99th greatest investors. What is the secret to your success?
Well, thank you. I think the secret to our success is a couple of things. One, we have a terrific, terrific team. You know, I have folks at the firm who've been with us for 30 years, 25 years. Melody Hobson, our coach CEO, who I met when she was a prospective Princeton student, she's been with us 28 years and is a tremendous leader for us and allows me to focus on investing and picking stocks while she runs the rest of the company. So I'm really blessed to have a business partner like Melody Hobson and the rest of the experienced team that we've had. I think the second thing is we're really, to be successful in this business, you have to not follow the crowd. You have to have the kind of personality that can be a contrarian, who can think independently and look out past all the noise that might be going on and all the headlines and the drama of the moment. That's hard to do because when the markets are going down and the headlines are screaming and people are saying, you know, the world is coming to an end, it takes a certain amount of independence in thinking, a certain amount of courage to buy when others are selling. You know, Warren Buffett, the greatest investor of all time, always says you've got to be greedy when others are fearful. And so I think we have that temperament, that ability to go against the grain, and that's led to a lot of our success as an investment firm. And then finally, I would say we're very, very focused. All that I do at Ariel is focus on small and mid-sized companies. We've been fishing in the same fishing pond for 37 years. You learn from your experiences, you learn from your mistakes, you get better at what you do. So this idea of being focused, being independent, having a great team around you, I think that's led to our success.
Now, you mentioned Melanie Hobson twice.
Yeah.
I think we need to pay homage to her and just tell everybody her television appearances, that because I see a lot on television.
Yes.
Tell us what stations we've seen her on.
Well, she's a regular contributor on the CBS morning show. She also is a regular on Tom Joyner's radio show, and she writes a column for Black Enterprise. So she's been very active in especially focused on investor education, financial literacy for young people, financial literacy for our community. She's really passionate about those issues. And then, of course, she's had outstanding business success. You know, she's the vice chairman of Starbucks. She's on the board of J.P. Morgan Chase. She used to be the chairman of DreamWorks Animation and worked closely with Jeffrey Katzenberg there. So she's arguably one of the most successful African-American women financial executives in the country.
And the reason I want you to mention that is because I wanted the people, our audience, to listen and see how accomplished you and your firm and Melanie Hobson are, so that you're not a fly-by-night investment company. You've been around for 37 years. You have experience. You're on different boards. And you yourself on some boards that you didn't mention.
Yes. Well, thank you for mentioning that. I've been very, very, very fortunate to be on some terrific, terrific boards. So currently, I serve here in New York on the board of the New York Times, which is especially interesting these days with what's going on in our political world. Secondly, I've been on the McDonald's board for 18 years. Or so, and I just love the experience there at McDonald's. And I joined the Nike board a year ago, which is kind of perfect for me since I had the chance to play basketball in college. And so having New York Times, Nike, McDonald's, it's a chance to really try to make a difference and try to make sure that we're pushing all companies to work more with minority businesses and give access to all of us in our community and have more minority leaders in these corporations. And then finally, I'm in my nonprofit side. I'm the vice chairman of the University of Chicago, and I'm also on the board of the Presidential Foundation and Library. So we're going to build a great presidential library in Chicago to honor President Obama.
That's quite an accomplishment for you and Melanie and your whole team. Almost 36 years after the founding of Ariel, the percentage of people of color in the financial services is still low. How can we, as a society, change that and also create more career opportunities for minority students?
Well, Well, I think we have to do a couple of things. You know, when it comes to students, we've done a couple of things that we're really proud of. We started 22 years or so ago a small public school called the Ariel Community Academy when former Secretary of Education Arne Duncan was working for us at Ariel. We teach financial literacy there. We're getting young kids. There's 500 African-American kids at the Ariel Community Academy. We're giving them real money to invest in real stocks and exposing them to the markets and the magic of compound interest, and also hopefully role models like myself and Melody and others. They get to see us and think about financial services careers. So we're hoping this will be a it will motivate other financial services companies to partner with other urban public schools the way we have. Secondly, we have a program at the University of Chicago for minority students to get paid internships to work in the investment offices of major endowments. And we think that's a great place to learn about the investment world, is to work for, you know, a big endowment that's pushing their money into all kinds of asset classes. The third thing, though, to make a difference for all of us, I think all of us that are leaders, leaders in corporate boardrooms, leaders in the executive suites, people who are running nonprofits, to churches, to corporations, or what have you, we have to go back to that playbook that Maynard Jackson and Harold Washington made so famous. They insisted that all the anchor institutions in their communities work with black firms. And they realized that those black firms would create philanthropy for our community, but also would employ people and be role models for the industries they were in. So people like Maynard and Harold made sure the financial services companies had real opportunities in their cities. And again, they push those other anchor institutions to do the right thing. So I think that's really critically important. And also the final thing they did is they forced the big majority firms that worked with them to have black partners and managing directors on the accounts with the city. And all of us can do that because it's kind of up to us. You know, we can't wait for the white folks to start to do the things that Maynard and Harold fought so hard for. We've got to do that when we're in our own leadership roles and not accept you know, the status quo, and not let all the economic opportunities go to the white folks and not to our community.
Okay. Now, you are widely regarded as a national voice for promoting diversity and inclusion in corporate boardrooms across America. Can you tell us why diversity is so important and more about your efforts in that area?
Well, thank you. About 17 years ago, we created a conference called the Black Corporate Directors Conference. And our original partners that are still with us are Russell Reynolds, the executive recruiting firm, and their senior partner, Charles Tribbett. A few years ago, we added Deloitte as a partner. So we've gone over these 17 years from roughly 30 African Americans on corporate boards that came to our conference to now last year, we had over 200 directors come to our conference, spending 3 days together. And the idea is we're trying to teach folks and remind people their responsibility to fight for our community once they're in the boardroom. So we say all the time, it's not just about getting more of us on the board. It's getting more of us on the board. They're going to fight for us when they're in those boardrooms. And to inspire people, every year we try to bring leaders who can be inspirational, what we call our conscience of the conference. So it could be folks from here in New York. We've had Calvin Butts. We've had Reverend Sharpton. Over the years, we've had Harry Belafonte. We've had Mark Morial. We've also had Andy Young, Congressman John Lewis, just people like that, often who fought with Dr. King, marched with Dr. King. You know, of course, Reverend Jackson's been at our conference. And all of these people are there to remind the blacks that are in the boardroom that people sacrifice so much to get these doors open for us. And if we sit there and don't fight for us, nothing changes. And in fact, you're giving the white firms the comfort to keep the status quo because they say, oh, I got my black director and they're not fighting for this. We must be doing things the right way. So that's the inspiration for the conference. Be leaders in the boardroom around civil rights issues. So I always tell Reverend Jackson, it's not about getting more of us on the board. It's getting more of us who have the right mindset to come on into these leadership roles. And that's what makes the difference.
Well, John, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this segment of Reaching Out. Listen, I enjoyed our conversation.
Me too.
I hope our audience enjoyed our conversation. And if you want to contact John Rogers at Ariel Investments, you can reach him at
312-726-0140.
Thank you once again.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to tune in again each and every Saturday at this same time for another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237. The preceding pre-recorded program paid for by Teamsters Local 237.